I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Let me read you some breaking news from the Associated Press virus update. New York sees its biggest one-day jump in coronavirus deaths, but new hospitalizations are down, and state officials are hopeful the surge is starting to level off. So this is, I think, the third or fourth straight day where those numbers are down. So joining me is our public health expert from Grand Forks, North Dakota, Don Shields, a retired Air Force guy. Don, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Great. Good morning to you, Mike.
I have a question for you. Is the NHL coming to Grand Forks?
Well, you know, they keep talking about doing things like that, and we've seen other games here in town. So, I'd love to see it. I know we're not going to be watching it in person, but, boy, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, it'd be great for the city. So the news is that the NHL is going to, you know, like the other leagues are considering doing, go to a central location and then play game after game after game and host some kind of postseason tournament or something. And so Grand Forks was in the news. I saw it. I let out a yell. So that would be awesome. Major League Baseball considered going to Arizona, and I've yet to see. I see where the NBA wants to do a horse tournament to get that on TV. But I would imagine the NBA wouldn't be far behind baseball and the NHL going to some place that had venues and enough hotels where they could put their teams, keep them quarantined, allow them to do social distancing, no people in the venue, a few cameramen, and put it on TV, and maybe reap some financial rewards from the entire planet sitting at home. So, but it would be interesting if Grand Forks could pull that one off. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it'd be great to see you.
Don, let me ask you, what in all of this, before I start asking questions, what do you find most interesting? As a guy who's been involved in public health your whole life?
What I find most interesting with this is how there are many aspects of what we're seeing with the coronavirus that we have seen before. But, you know, it's kind of like going through a hurricane or going through a tornado, going through a flood. No two events are exactly the same. There's always differences. But there's an awful lot that we've seen with this virus that actually makes me feel comforting to know that, okay, it's following some predictable patterns. It may not be patterns that you and I like, but it is following some predictable patterns.
I want to ask you about financing for pandemics. When I was elected, you know, you have maybe 5 or 6 or 10 things that you want to do, but you have the money to pay for 4 of them. I want to ask you, I'm sure when people talk about pandemics and you go to a conference and come back and report on it and you know, you speak about the, you know, the gravity. Bill Gates's, you know, speech from, 2015 that he gave about, you know, the potential of a pandemic. Yet when financial resources are scarce, as they are at every level of government or seem to be, how frustrating is it to be a public health person knowing that, you know, this is extremely deadly, but it doesn't look like, I mean, there's a story that the state of New York had a chance to buy 16,000 respirators, you know, 2 or 3 years ago and said, yeah, we're not going to do that. I'd be curious about your thoughts. You've fought those budget battles a lot and things like this that can be so catastrophic, but truth be told, it's a 100-year event. So, you know, are we going to fund that when we've got, you know, we're trying to do this, we're trying to do this, we're trying to give these people raises? Can you talk to me about funding and public health?
Well, you know, when we take a look at these, as we discussed the last time, we've seen 10 pandemics in 300 years. So I wouldn't necessarily say they're a 100-year event. I might say they're a 30-year event. We've seen since we really had the swine flu outbreak, that's only been 10 years ago when that occurred. One of the things I think helped us in that event was that we had older people that might have been exposed in the late 70s to a similar virus, and we didn't see the numbers of people that were ill. So we had some protection. Here we are seeing people without that protection. When you talk about economies, I think you're right. You know, how much do you spend? As a public health person, I'd like to see us spend a little more every year for those things we know we're going to have to surge with in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. Part of that issue is that when you buy those things, you need to rotate them. You need to make sure that the elastic and the mask have not disintegrated. You make sure they haven't gone moldy. You make sure that the equipment is up and running. Give me an example. When I, you and I had chatted before that I was in an air medical staging facility in Madrid, Spain, back for Desert Storm, right? Remember right. that?
Yeah, I do.
We had maybe 60, 70, 80 ambulances that were stored over near Madrid that we were that we would use when we surged. And all the military did was change the oil on those ambulances for about 10 years. So when we went in and turned the key and started those the first time to run them to the runway to take ill people off a plane, we had to send about 25 ambulances to make sure six made it, because although they changed the oil, they didn't necessarily run them and make sure that they were all doing what they were supposed to. So I think the military learned lessons from how you put things in stockpiles. And what I'm saying is I think we need to be spending money, a little bit of money every year for ventilators, for masks, for gloves. But we also need to be able to have the capacity to rotate those, to check them out and make sure they're good, or we have a large supply 20 years from now that aren't worth much.
You know, we the Marine Corps went through something similar. We do a thing called Maritime Pre-Positioned Forces, where we have equipment on container ships. And it they have, you know, a squadron of ships that has the gear that, you know, that you can use for, you know, just a brigade size organization. So about 3,000 to 5,000 Marines. And what we find every time we have to use the equipment is, you know, no matter how we exercise it, every time we roll that stuff off, it doesn't come off and start right away. There's parts that fail, you know, salt, the worst condition you could be in, right? Salt, heat, and salt water constantly as these squadrons roll around the sky, roll around the world. And same impact you had. And that's why even if you do exercise them and replace a bit on you're still going to have problems when you pull them out of mothballs. What have you seen, Don, relative to this whole permutation of we need to get a quicker, like, on-the-spot test. We need to have treatments, right, vaccine. Based on what you've seen, you know, you have any thoughts on how those things are progressing as you've watched this thing unfold?
Well, you know, as we take a look, we can see now that there's at least a dozen promising vaccine candidates being tested around the world. By that, I mean they're in final stages of development or have started some human trials for the vaccine. The second part of that would be, do we have protection from antibodies? So what's going on in terms of antibodies testing, and if people come down ill or display the right number of antibodies, can they go back to work? Last Thursday, the FDA just approved the first company on a rapid antibody test, the serology for that. And the Mayo Clinic said that yesterday they had one. So some of those, like, antibody protection things are starting to come online. These are things that aren't going to, you know, be available, you know, in a week, you know, at least not widespread. We've seen what's happened with how do you get the tests out there, you know, and we've been trying in America to get tests out there since, well, January, really since the 7th of March, since the new test became available. I think the third thing, not only the vaccine and the antibodies, but it's also what is the makeup of that? By that I mean is just because you have an antibody test, what level is good enough? Just because you have a flu shot or a shot for coronavirus, a lot of people kind of think, well, that's just one shot. Or just to give you an example, you know, when we in public health go out and do flu shots, it's not just one shot. There are shots that are licensed for kids under age 2. There are shots that are good for kids 0 to 5.5 years old. people 0 through 19, people 19 to 60, 60 to 80. So when you say, I want a flu shot, well, it's not just one shot. So it won't be just one coronavirus shot. It'll be based upon how big of a dose do they need. Is it been tested so that it doesn't hurt people in those quantities at those ages? It's all a little bit different. So I know people are saying, I want that coronavirus shot, but it's not one, you know what I mean? It's not just one shot they're looking at. So it's more complex than that. And that takes time to do those clinical tests and to be able to get there. I'm certainly hoping that some of these treatments that they've been experimenting with, they've had over about 300 of those, plus over 300 throughout the world that they're looking at for treatments. And, you know, we've seen some mention with the chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine or other types of things like falavir, antiviral drugs being tested. But there's over three of those being tested to see which ones work, which ones don't do more harm, which ones don't work. And those are going to take time. So I'm glad to see those starting, but it's kind of like what you and I said about, well, how quickly can we get ventilators, you know, and that's not a two-week issue either.
Right, right. What has given you that you've seen the greatest cause for hope relative to your, you know, industry of public health or maybe one particular issue? Is there something that you've seen, Don, that you've said, you know what, you know, in the midst of all of this, and there's going to be people that die, and that's tragic, but there are going to be some good things that come out of this. Have you seen anything like that that you would talk to us about?
Well, you know, I think there seems to be probably, 90% of the people in America seem to be doing the right thing. By that, I mean making smart choices and staying home and trying to stop the rapid virus from circulating in America. And that's what we know works right now without a vaccine, without treatments and those types. And I think about 90% of the people are doing that. Certainly, there's probably 10% of the people you just shake your head to and go, how can people do that in this day and age? You know, when they see somebody who's died or see somebody ill from this disease and see what's happening to our medical community and see what's happening to employees out of work and businesses, how can they keep doing the 10%? But I have a lot of faith in the 90%, and I have a lot of faith in the fact that, you know, friends of mine call me every day. How you doing? You know, you guys are not ill. You're still doing fine. You need something? Hey, I've got some extra of this. I can leave it on your front porch if you need it. So I think those things have been very good to see.
I got an email. Mac, I enjoyed the conversation with, and then in parentheses it says, is it Dr. or Mr. Shield? So Don, I just called him Don. But is it Dr. Shields?
No, it's not Dr. Shields. I have a master's degree in business from the University of North Dakota. I have a master's degree in healthcare administration from Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And then we talked about my experience in the military with hospitals and clinics and public health. So, no, not a doctor. Don's great. I've been called a lot worse than that.
There you go. The email goes on. Could he give the nation a grade? In his profession, I'm sure he's seen communities, states, and federal agencies in various states of readiness and disrepair. I'm curious how he thinks, knowing that that is simply the lay of the land, and I think your conversation about funding is very enlightening for the rest of us. Although people might talk about it, it's not there because it doesn't rise to the priority given competing requirements in somebody's budget. I got that. Given all of that, could Don give us a letter grade relative to how he believed the nation has responded? I'm encouraged when I see states like Washington and California returning ventilators to the national stockpile and this discussion about surging in different parts of the nation, both in terms of hardware, in terms of portable facilities that the military seems to be standing up all over the place, and also the migration of medical professionals to those impacted areas. I would be curious about Don's thoughts on how we performed. So, Don, Dr. Shield?
Well, not doctor, but, you know, I think that's a great question. I think there's two parts of that. How are we performing individually as people in America? And I think how is our government performing in this crisis? What, you know, and this crisis could have been, this happens to be a pandemic, but could have been a hurricane or a tornado or some other flooding or some other disaster. So I think I'd like to split it. I would like to say that people basically, I'd give them an 8 out of 10. I think people are seeing what's happening, and I think they're trying. Some of them may be trying harder than others, but, you know, I think they're trying, and they're trying to help their neighbors. So I'd give them an 8 out of 10.
What about – okay, so that's the people. So hold on. I'm going to write these down. So the people get an 8 out of 10.
Would you grade the people?
You know what? I'm – based on what I've seen, you know, I just saw a poll that said 97% of Americans that responded to a poll said they are avoiding, you know, larger groups of 10 or more people. I only venture out to go to the store, essentially. That's all, you know, that's all I do. Maybe to go get fast food. And I don't even, right, there's now a plexiglass partition between, thank God, I think, for those people, but for the clerk at the grocery store, there's a plexiglass piece of plexiglass between, you know, me and we and them. And I think that that's good for them. I'm curious whether that will ever come down in the future. That might be something we're here to, but when somebody gets near me, I kind of look at them and say, man, get away from me. So I shy away if I don't know you from, you know, I keep 6 feet away at least. And so I think that's pretty interesting. So I would, and in California and Washington, you know, and I think I said this last time, but I see a fundamentally different curve than happened in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, because we don't have a mature subway system that I think is the catalyst and the perfect incubator for spreading the virus. And if you don't have a mature mass transit system, I think you exist on a different plane. And so I would grade the nation pretty high. I think there were business decisions that got made. One was made in New Orleans. And another one was made in Florida to allow spring break and Mardi Gras to go forward, that in the rearview mirror, we're going to look at those and say, look, when we see something like this developing, you know, we're probably going to have to say no next time. Now, you're going to have business people say, if it's maybe, you can't say no. It costs us all too much money. So I would echo your comments. I think when you see what's happened in California and in most states around the nation, the people have been, you know, extremely cooperative and doing the right thing that's in the best interest of, you know, older people in their family, younger people with health issues, and them in general. I think the nation has responded admirably. I worry, though, Don, when 53% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, you know, financially, you know, bad things are in the future for businesses and for people, and I worry about that, though.
Well, you know, I think you're right. And again, I think we're echoing the fact that I think individually we're starting to make smarter decisions, and I think we're making smarter decisions as we're going along and tightening it up. I think, as you're right, California, Washington, I think tightened it up pretty early, a lot earlier than I see on the East Coast. And I think you're seeing some benefits of that. In terms of the government, boy, as a public health person, I wish they would have curtailed the traveling issues in January. I wish they would have started trying to find a way to get us more gloves and masks and ventilators in January. The fact that we didn't start that until March, I probably say I can't grade our federal response, our government, more than a 5.
Okay.
I think they're doing some things now that are good, but I think they started late. I also see some states, even North Dakota. You know, we've not yet had the governor say, have a stay-at-home order. It's all voluntary. Now, just today, Fargo and West Fargo, the mayor said, we've had enough. We're ordering people to stay at home. But those are mayors, and I don't understand why North Dakota hasn't done that. I don't understand why the governor in Georgia opens up the beaches. You know, the wave is coming. It's kind of like a wildfire, right? You see it, the smoke on the other side of the hill, but if you wait till that wildfire gets to your house on this side of the hill, it's too late. So 5. I would say 5. And in terms of cost, I would say the cost is a lot less than the to buy some of this stuff and stock it up ahead of time than it is the price we're paying in our economy now.
And that will be the argument going forward, right? And, yeah, and that so. You're talking about pennies on the dollars if to go through. I mean, by the time that this is all accounted for, the economic carnage that will ensue is going to be absolutely amazing, right? I mean, it's going to be. You know, the president made a comment yesterday about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We spent $9 trillion on. And it's just, you hear that and you think, good Lord, what could we have done in our own country, you know, had we not done those things? That's a lot of money. But you talk about something that will put pressure to get us out of both Iraq and Afghanistan, and that is the clawback that's going to happen after, you know, these bailouts. And, you know, as you just alluded to, Don, if, you know, as a public health person, look, you know, we've had this discussion about this is not very high, and whether it's a 30-year or the Spanish flu was 100 years ago. That's what I was thinking of in my head, that something that was this big. And you saw that this thing cost the country, the economic impact was $7 or $8 trillion. So we're asking you to spend, you know, $50 billion on this stuff, on these things. And so we can stockpile them, so we can at least have the assets in place, you know, so that we can mitigate it better and not have to cost ourselves $8 trillion in terms of an economic impact. And I don't know, I wasn't a politician for very long, Don, but I think you'd find a more sympathetic audience today than you would have a few years ago.
Yeah. Unfortunately, experience is a good teacher.
Right. Right. You know, my mother used to quote Abraham Lincoln, Michael, right? A wise man learns from others' experience, and a fool learns from his own. I'm like, all right, Mom. Yep. Normally, she said that after I did something stupid. I want to ask you. I'll read you another email, and I was going to head this way, but I'll let the email do it. Matt, could you ask, and then in quote, Dr. Shields, what are the steps to come out of this? I've heard a number of people talk about it. I'd be curious to hear what he thinks. Are the things in terms of testing that needs to be in place, in terms of this term I now use, prophylactic measures that need to be in place, that will all be bridges to a virus shot that hopefully we'll all get within a year? So how do we come out of this?
You know, I think there needs to be a plan put together for that, because there's a lot of people with a lot of good ideas. What do I think? You know, we're going to have to know where we're at with data to say, when can we come out of this? I mean, you're not going to say, I'm going to come out of this before I reach the apex, go down the other side, and then how can I do that? Because until 70% of the population gets antibodies for this virus, we're going to continue to see waves coming where they may be 3 or 4 months apart, but we're going to continue to see those waves of illness outbreaks. And so you're going to have some measure where we're at in that first wave, which is where we're at now. We've got to have a measure on how protected are people right now. How many people have been exposed to this illness? How many people have antibodies? I think we're just at the beginning of even developing the serology testing that can be used. And we're not even to the point where we're getting it out there, but we're just developing that. But I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is getting a vaccine in place so that those that haven't been exposed can get that immunity and we can get through this cycle. How long is this all going to take? Well, I think from now until the end of it, we're talking 12 months at best, maybe 9 months, you know, before we get enough herd immunity. So, you know, we're not going to be sitting here saying some people have to stay home and others don't. I think this brings up a good issue, though, and that is how many people have these? How many cases do we have of coronavirus in America, right?
People, you know, I saw the president talking yesterday and said, look, you know, we have the most coronavirus cases in the world. And he said, and I think he makes a good point, and you can comment on this. He said, well, the reason we do is because we've tested more than anybody else in the world. And he said, when you look at our per capita testing numbers, you know, we've tested more. And so we found more. So I don't, does anybody have a good answer to that question, Don?
Well, you know, I know per capita we haven't. We're not the number one tester in the world.
Oh, who
places
is?
Like South Korea are the number one per capita tested. And there's places like Italy that have tested more on a per capita basis than the U.S. There's places like Germany that have tested more. But I won't go there. People can do it. But let's take a look at some of the numbers, and I think it would help us. 2 weeks ago when you and I chatted, we were reporting 392,000 cases in the world and 43,000 cases in the U.S. 2 weeks later, today, we're 1.3 million reported cases, confirmed cases in the world, 368,000 in the U.S., almost as much as they were reporting in the whole world 2 weeks ago. In terms of deaths, 2 weeks ago, we had 543 in the U.S., 17,000 in the world. Today, there's 76,000 in the world and 11,000 in the U.S. That's been, in 2 weeks, an eightfold increase in the number of confirmed cases, 18-fold increase in the number of deaths, and we're seeing about 1,000 a day in deaths. Now, when you take a look at cases, you know, when I go back to look at the flu, and the flu doesn't appear to be as rapidly transmitting as this coronavirus is. By that, I mean, I think it's easier to catch a coronavirus, it appears, than to catch the flu. But when we were dealing with flu statistics, for every confirmed case of the flu, the rule of thumb in public health is about 20 cases that went unconfirmed because people who had the real mild cases didn't go to the doctor, didn't get admitted to the hospital and get tested. Well, you and I have chatted over the last couple of weeks that, well, number one, there weren't tests to test them, right? So we don't know really how many people were ill in January and February and have recovered, right? Because we weren't testing them. People right now in Grand Forks here, you know, I can't get a test if I want one. I'd have to be admitted to the hospital to be a healthcare worker. So we really, these confirmed tests are just the tip of the iceberg. So if we really think it's going to be at least 20 times the number of confirmed cases. So if we're sitting here saying that we have 17,000 or so cases in the U.S. now, basically, we have 20 times that number, right? 500,000. So I think there's a lot of people out there, I guess my bottom line on that, there's a lot of people out there that have probably come down with this and have antibodies and immunity that could go back to work that we don't know about because we're not testing for that part of it. We're not testing enough to find out who has it or and where it's at. We're not testing at all yet, really, on who has the antibodies.
I'm looking at this is from Our World Data. Total tests for COVID-19 per million people. Number one is Austria. Number two is Australia. Number three is Germany. Number four is South Korea. Number five is Finland. Number six is the United States. Seven is France. Eight is United Kingdom, South Africa, Vietnam, Japan. So those are the kind of the per capita. That's per million as a way of ranking. So I stand corrected.
And then you take a look at like North Korea that doesn't report any. you don't have many numbers in Iran. You don't have much coming out of Russia either.
Right.
But you see in Wuhan, they reported 3,000 deaths, right? But why was it that they shipped 30,000 urns in there to dispose of the cremated people who died?
They probably got a good price on them. No.
Not all the numbers are the same, but I think you're right. When we take a look at the some of these countries that you mentioned, I think those are probably some very credible numbers, although they're underreported.
Right. Another email. Mac, can you guys go back relative to the next month or so for us to come out of it? What has to happen? That's kind of confusing to me. Yeah, so Don, what has to happen for us to get to where the majority of – let's just exclude anybody who's over the age of 65 and people with, you know, health conditions that shouldn't go back to work. All right. So for everybody else who's generally healthy, what are the steps for them to go back to work? How do we do that?
Yeah. You know, again, I think we have to say, where is this wildfire? Right now, we're only seeing hot spots, really, in New York and Louisiana, Miami, Detroit, some of the hubs. We're not seeing all across the country yet. I'm not seeing a lot of numbers in North Dakota. I mean, I see in North Dakota yesterday, we reported that we had 19 people in the hospital and 11 new cases. 4 were greater than 60, 7 were less than 50 years of age. So we're not seeing that. Number one, we have to let that wave come across America. And then after it comes through, places like New York that maybe may see that first, maybe they can start testing for antibodies and allowing people to go back to work and run the subways and reopen the shops and reopen the businesses. But that's going to be several weeks away. I mean, we don't know on this curve that we're on whether the top of it is going to be a peak and go down and take as long to go down as it did to go up a month, or whether it's going to flatten for a while. And, you know, if I take a look at the flood in Grand Forks right now, our river's up. I mean, our Sleepy River, normally 14-foot river, we're running at 45 feet today. And I'm just glad we have the flood protection system in. We're going to run at 45, 46 feet for a week before it starts to come down. We don't know if this coronavirus is going to plateau for a while. I suspect we're going to see a plateauing in America without a real big drop-off, because as New York and Boston and New Jersey and Connecticut start to come out of it, we're going to see the Chicagos and the St. Louis and the Atlanta and the other in Denver and places like that in rural areas start to come in. So I think our numbers are going to stay up for a while. I don't think we can really think about coming out of this until maybe toward earlier part of June, when we see a lot of that first wave have rolled through the country.
So if you're advising the president and his task force, or the vice president and that task force, the optimism about maybe 1 May, you know, a lot of us can begin to go back to work, you would say that would be over-optimistic?
I think that's over-optimistic. I think when I look at the curves in history, I think we're going to still see peaking going on in America through maybe the middle part of May.
The experts that
I read seem to kind of feel this is going to go from mid-April through mid-May for some of the peaks.
And you're no stranger to the next question. With 52% of the nation living paycheck to paycheck, and we're beyond that already, 72% of the nation said they couldn't miss a paycheck and still function fully as a household. The economic pain that's going to ensue, we've already seen evidently increases in domestic violence across the country. But, you know, food pantries reporting that they're running out of food now as people are coming that don't have any money. What's the balance between that and, you know, the public health requirements, the economic reality versus public health? How do you advise on the side of public health? Let's split the difference. People got to go back to work. I mean, to be honest, I mean, tying up the whole state of North Dakota when you have 19 people in the hospital of 700,000 seems crazy to me.
Well, you know, I think you might think that it sounds crazy in terms of North
crazy
Dakota.
Crazy was the wrong word, okay?
Overzealous. Go ahead.
I would say it sounds a bit aggressive to me in terms of where we shake out in terms of policy. If I put public health, 100% public health on one side, 100% economic on the other, I would say you're skewing too hard to public health and you're strangling our economy when we don't have the number of cases that warrant that. And my theory, and you can comment on this too, Don, is I think there's two curves in the country. One if you have a mature mass transportation system, and one if you don't. And so I think the one that once New York clears through this, and its incredible mass transportation system, in my opinion, that has hyper-injected that into the community, you're going to see a different curve take over, and it's going to be much lower. So having said that, you don't have to ascribe to it, of course. I mean, to me, you got to – I don't know. I would be more inclined to say, look, people got to get back to work. I mean, what's going to happen? How do we feed people? You know, what do we do? And because we've never, I mean, in my lifetime and in your lifetime, Don, we've even World War II wasn't like this. I mean, there was rationing and things like that, but people still went to work. They had money in their pocket. They could live. And now we're talking about a case where the majority of the country is sitting at home, you know, and 52% of them can't miss a paycheck. That's, I don't know how we live like that.
You know, I think those are a lot of good questions in there. I would say one thing you ought to read, and that's a guy by the name of Jonathan Smith. He's a Yale epidemiologist professor. He published a good article on April 5th about holding the line when it comes to stay-at-home orders and social distancing, because social distancing saves lives. I think when we take a look at that, I look and say, you know, when people get together and it only takes one person in a group to make other folks ill, it takes 14 days for that to manifest, and a week or two before those people become ill enough so that they may end up being deaths. We've seen in the last 2 weeks how that surged, but those are cases that have occurred before. It's an easy mistake to make when the numbers are down or you don't see them around you or the numbers are flat to say, can't help in here, let's open it up. And I'll give you three examples. I'll just do three and then I'll be quiet. You know, let's take rural Ketchum, Idaho. Ketchum, Idaho is Sun Valley ski area, right?
Right.
It's a rural mountain area. It's about maybe 100 miles from Boise, kind of off to the east. And it's a ski area. And they were very lately affected. They shut down their ski area March 15th, right, shortly after the president declared it a national emergency. There weren't cases around them. They were very lately affected. They were watching New York and saying, hey, I don't think it can happen here. Today, in a county of 2,000 people, Sun Valley, Idaho, ski area, they have 399 confirmed cases and two deaths, all traced to tourism that happened before the 15th of March. It's one of the highest infection rates in the country, so it doesn't take much. I'll give you another example. Chambers County, Alabama, a rural place, right? Right. It's a small rural county. 74 people were ill last Friday, and it was traced to church service 2 weeks ago. Mount Vernon, Washington, about an hour north of Seattle, 45 members of a choir and two deaths, 45 people are ill and two people died when 60 choir members practiced on March 10th. So we didn't see those illnesses for March 10th until 2 or 3 weeks later. What I'm telling you is you don't see it around you now, but if you don't do these things until after this wave goes through around the nation and you open that door up in 2 or 3 weeks, you're worse off than you would have been if you would have faced the heat. I think what we need to see is more help from the federal government in terms of paycheck replacements or debt forgiveness or whatever it takes to help people. I've told you before, my daughter got laid off 2 weeks ago. This last Friday, she got her first unemployment check, and the first unemployment check was about a fourth or third of what she normally would make. We're having to help her make her mandatory payments of a house loan and a car loan and those kinds of things. I think it's going to take a combination of all that, but that's what the government, I think, is for, is to step in and help when it's bigger than any one of us. I don't know. Does that help?
Well, it'll be interesting because, we've already, I think what the first, we're at like $4 trillion now. Relative to stimuli and economic stimulus. These are hard issues.
Weren't we spending, $1 billion a month in Iraq and $1 billion a month in Afghanistan for 20 years?
I told you. If you want to see us a case made for getting our ass out of there and we can't afford to be in those places anymore because it ain't going right, it's happening here domestically. What? So I don't have a good answer. What? So whether we say it's May 1st or June 1st or July 1st, what are the steps to come out of this, Don? In terms of what's the sequence of events that would happen in terms of, and I still think, right, social distancing is here to stay until there's a vaccine, right? All these things are going to, you know, that plexiglass is going to stay probably forever, but it at least has to stay until the nation's vaccinated. But whether it's one of those dates on one of those months, what's the sequence of events that allow, what has to be in place in terms of testing? In terms of treatment, again, short of a vaccine, in terms of treatment that has to be in place for us to begin to go back to work. And again, knowing that until the vaccine's there, all these social distancing, same social distancing rules will probably apply.
Yeah, I think you've hit a lot of them there. I think it includes the doing it smartly based on science. Bringing the people, some of the brightest people in the country together and say, let's have a plan. I think the plan has got to be based on science. To me, the science without a vaccine is antibodies. We have to know who can come back and who's still at risk. And we need to taper that probably by where you live in the country and where this wave has gone through. I would expect, you know, they could do antibody testing and bring people in on the East Coast in Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey before they can bring people into Denver and areas out west.
So now I go in, I have a test that says I have the antibodies in my system. I can go back
and
to work.
And it's the right level and all that kind of stuff.
And so, and that's going to be the test. Now talk about, we've talked about these, you know, kind of like a pregnancy test being developed that would tell you, instantaneously or in very short order, whether you have it or not. What role will that play?
Well, you know, I think that helps a lot in terms of where it's out in the community and contact tracing and who needs to be in quarantine.
Okay, so could you explain? So contact tracing means I test positive and I sit down and I make a list of these are all the people I've contacted. That's what, when we're talking about contact tracing, is that what we're talking about?
That's right. And those people that are of high risk, you have them stay at home in a environment for 14 days so that see if they test positive, if they come up positive or not.
Got it.
That's how you break the cycle, right?
Okay. But that's just talking about, so one part of this is if I have the antibodies in the appropriate, you know, ratios, then I know that it's gone through me. And I should be able to go back to work and be part of this group that begins to move. If I don't have it and I'm not in an at-risk group, what happens to me if you were king for a day?
Well, I think it depends on where this wave is. I think if the wave has come through this and has dropped off in the June timeframe, there may be additional things that people can do in the July, August, September, until we start seeing another wave. So some of those people can do that until we get a vaccine. So I think it's going to depend upon where you're at in the country. I think it's going to depend upon if you have antibodies. But right now, we don't know who has antibodies. We don't know who's even come down with this disease, because for every confirmed case, there's at least 20 out there that probably came down with it and we haven't seen. So there's probably a lot more people that could go back to work if we could test them, right?
Right. So how do we test for that?
Well, we have to get an FDA-approved fast test. The labs can't just go in there and say, do you have antibodies? Right. It's got to be based on serology. It's got to be FDA-approved. And they've done one company last Thursday on a fast track. So that company would have to, and others would have to, make the tests available by the millions. I mean, we have 300 million people in America. I mean, we have to make the test available, right? Or you have to have been proven to have come down with it and have recovered out of a hospital.
Wow.
But we know that number is only, you know, 368,000 confirmed cases out of 300 million, right? So that's just a small subset. But I think that's how we do it. We start rolling it out that way smartly. And then those people who can't, I think we have to have government support to help them until we can get there.
So it's government support on a scale that fluctuates relative to your ability to go back to work. So we have to develop the test for the antibodies, and we have to get that out there in great numbers, and that begins to clear people to be able to go back to work, right? And that gets you kind of you're eligible to go back to work mode. And if don't have the antibodies, then you would get more government assistance in your model, and you would be forced to stay at home.
Well, or practice social distancing. Maybe not stay at home. Maybe you can go and get food out of a restaurant to your car, but maybe you wouldn't be in there sitting in a booth.
Got it. What about your ability to go to work? No?
I would say that you probably should not be at work unless this wave has gone by.
Bye.
And you could do it. And it's not only people at work. If you're working in a restaurant, but there aren't enough people to come in and buy from that restaurant or business, you know, how's that business going to make enough money to pay your salary? So it's not just people at work. It's people who are well enough to spend money and feel comfortable spending money in a time of impact like this.
Here's an email. Matt, could you ask Don, when he talks about this wave crashing over the bow where you live in the country, what exactly does he mean, and what defines? If he could use New York City as an example, where are they relative to this wave? And once it washes over them, then what? So could you explain that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Governor Cuomo said they think they are approaching the peak of their wave, and they think that peak is lower than it would have been. We know that New York didn't take steps early on, so I'm hoping that the wave or the peak throughout the country is a lot less than what was initially forecast in models if we did nothing. I think physical distancing is helping us. So I think the wave, hopefully throughout the country, is lower than the number of needs we have for ventilators. Okay, I'd say we need to see how many people are becoming ill around us, and need to see how many people are recovering in order to see where that wave is at. But I don't know, and I don't know if anybody could tell you, is the wave in New York going to plateau for a while, or is it going to come down over the next month, so just as slow as it went up? And are we going to see just as many cases on the other side of that wave as we saw going up this side of the wave?
So
I think there's a lot we don't know.
What statistic relative to the wave do you think is most important? For instance, today is being heralded, you know, I just read the report from the Associated Press, as a positive day, even on a day when the jump in number of deaths related to COVID-19 has jumped in New York City, but the number of new cases continues to go down. The number of ICU admissions continues to go down, and I think the number of diagnosis total went down. So is there any one of those statistics that you concentrate on more than the other, or is it them in the aggregate?
I think it's the number of new cases. You know, we know that the deaths lag by 10 days to 2 weeks
right. After
you come down with the illness. Right. And we've seen, even if you look at Boris Johnson, you know, in England, you can see, you know, 9, 10, 11 days into an episode, he has some problems. And it seemed to think, when you take a look around at the coronavirus, that even people suffering from mild conditions seem to have problems 9 or 10 or 11 days into it. So deaths is a lagging statistic by a couple of weeks. I think a more reliable statistic is what is the rate of new infections.
Got it.
In a community.
Got it. It is not, you know, a lot of times I talk about problems as complex parenthetical problems, and this is certainly one of them. I mean, you can talk about the fiscal aspect of this in terms of resources, you know, devoted to public health. You can talk about economic impact relative to this, to the fate of so many families and people across the country and the nation in general. You could talk about mortality. So it is a complex parenthetical. Before I let you go, Don, is there anything that I haven't been smart enough to ask you this morning that, that you want to share with us?
Well, I think just two quick things. One, there's a great CDC study that's dated March 26. They looked at people under age 19. They had 2,700 or so people who were ill, three deaths. And what they said were a lot of those young people didn't experience fever, cough, shortness of breath. But there's still been, you know, three deaths in that group. So young people seem to be doing a little bit better with it, even though they're coming down ill. So that's one thing I would say. I think it would be an early mistake to open things up too soon. I think I would like to see our federal government workers and our state government folks listen to the medical experts on medical issues. And I would like to see us having maybe one national message instead of some mixed messages being sent out. And I think physical distancing saves lives.
The president has said, though, he can't constitutionally order that, which I'm not a constitutional law scholar. But I always thought that the governors are best suited to know what's best for their state. I saw Dr. Fauci talking about, you know, Nebraska and maybe Missouri yesterday. And he said, look, when I spoke, he said they don't have a shelter in place order, but all the other things they're doing amount to a shelter in place order. And he didn't comment on Florida. And I can't remember who else is pretty high visible in not having them. You don't have a date where you say you have circled to say June 1st would be more to when I would think that it would be, we would have both the testing in place and enough people on the backside of this wave, which it would tend to be more towards June than it would be into May. You don't have something like that. You would say, follow the data.
I think we need to follow the data. I think 2 weeks ago when we were chatting about when our ventilators going to be ready, you know, I know for people that I talk to that are in labs, they don't have the quick test machines to be able to give you a coronavirus test result in 3 or 4 minutes or 15 minutes. They're still waiting for that equipment 2 weeks later. So, you know, we may come off of this wave.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but so when we talk about that testing, there's a software component and a hardware component to that, right?
I mean, reagents. Chemicals, so you can run the test.
Got it.
Swabs, you know, do you have enough, you know, swabs?
And all those things have to be, you know, disseminated nationwide when somebody says, yeah, they're available, to have that be a part of your daily life.
Right. And for an antibody test, it's a serology, right? That's a blood test. You got to take someone's blood. You know, you got to have a needle and a syringe, right? And then we have to have a test tube. So it's more than just licensing a test or telling GM to make ventilators, right? And we're 2 weeks and we haven't seen the ventilator yet. So when we talk about where we're going to be at the 1st of June, I think we're going to see cases start to go away and we can start opening things up or think about how to do it smartly. But are we going to have in place the testing? Are we going to have in place, you know, companies with the serology? Gee, I don't know. I'd like to see us move faster than we're moving.
But, you know, but again, even moving, you know, you'll hear public health people say, hey, you know, relative to public health, we're moving at the sound of, you know, at the speed of sound right now, relative to the way, you know, public health tends to move. But look, you can't get there from here given the scope of this problem. And as much as people might want to hear a different answer, there is no different answer, yay?
No, I don't think there is a different answer yet. I think people need to make smart choices. Right now, if I'm sitting here in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I already told you 225 cases in the state of North Dakota. Boy, what I tell my friends, don't go to the store unless it's emergency. Don't go to the pharmacy unless it's emergency. This data lags by 2.5 weeks. We know there's 20 cases for every one confirmed you find. This is not the time to make 2 trips this week to the grocery store. See if you can maybe go once every 2 weeks or borrow something from a friend that you know that's not ill. Now's the time to stay the course.
All right, sir. First of all, I always enjoy the conversation, and I appreciate you taking time out of your mid-morning to join us here on Almarine Radio. So I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion, as I did last time, Don. Thank you very much, and God bless you, and good luck to your daughter. And hopefully this stuff turns around quicker and people can get back to work. But I think we're all starting to understand public health a little bit. And if there's one trend that I've noticed, is it's going to take longer than you think. And yeah, it's not the way we're used to living our lives these days. And so it goes. So thank you very much, Don.
Thank you. It's not a fast hamburger through a chain restaurant. You know, it's going to take longer than that, but always appreciate doing it. And you challenge us to think about things that we should be thinking about and talking about. So thank you very much.
No, I appreciate you coming on and going through the footnotes and making us smart and explaining things to us. So there you have it. A product of the United States Air Force, Don Shields. Thanks, Don. That'll do it. Yeah, that's it today. That's the show. Talking public health here on a Tuesday. If you excuse me, if you're just tuning in hour one, we talk about the relief of the captain of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And actually what I did was I played the entire 17-minute speech that he gives, and you're going to hear some emails that come in on the back end of that. And I think you'll find it pretty interesting. Somebody hit record on their cell phone when he started speaking on the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And I will say this. I watched the coverage yesterday, and people cherry-picked out of that whole 17 minutes. They tended to cherry-pick the too naive or too stupid to be in command of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. Everybody extracted that one. And then there was one other one. I can't remember it off the top of my head. And so then they made their comments. When you listen to the whole 17 minutes, as unprofessional as it is in spots, you can tell a couple things. One, he's pissed. Two, that he personally, the Secretary of the Navy, which again brings up a whole series of questions, but he personally was in contact with Captain Crozier. Captain Crozier told him personally that he was satisfied with what was going on, and then this letter shows up. So there's a lesson in there. When you're pissed, don't go talk to the media. Don't go talk to the crew of a ship. And assume that everything you say is going to be, you know, is going to be, you'll answer for at some point. That's always a pretty good assumption. Now, I got an email that said, you know, it wasn't, you know, would love to hear what General Mattis said. Well, I mean, General Mattis has been put out in timeout corner for saying other indelicate things, right? You know, and the fact that General Mattis got to where he was, a little bit of a miracle. You know, the what was his comments about killing people's fun as a general officer? No. I don't think you could really understand that until your day-to-day job is to help kill people and help save people. I don't think it makes any sense to anybody until that's your job. But he survived that. Yeah, stayed on active duty as a general officer. And he survived a couple other indelicate things. A lot of people don't. So, again, and you know what? I think that's part of what's wrong with the DOD and why we don't stand up when there's a big crisis, when there's a big decision, because we take people that are strong-willed and sometimes fiery, and we say, yeah, that he's not what we need. We need, you know, Mr. Milquetoast over there, very cool head, doesn't say anything. He doesn't fight, though. And I'm more comfortable with Maudley, right, and airing it out and being pissed, and then him come back and saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Right? I mean, we could have put Patton in mothballs, but who rescued the guys at Bastogne? Who was the first person to their aid? George Patton. Right? And his Third Army. Right? Going through distances and through terrain and weather that people said, yeah, they're not going to be able to get through for another X number of days. Oh, no, they got there. So, to me, all the hand-wringing and, oh, the wrong tone, and, oh, he bitched him out, and, oh, it was unprofessional. I think we need a little bit more of that. We have too many professionals. We have too many suited, soft-spoken jackasses that have got us into places like Vietnam and places like Iraq and expanded the ground war in Afghanistan, right? All done by real smooth-talking, people. And then you had other people in military uniforms who rubber stamped that shit because they wouldn't fight them. They wouldn't take them on in public. And that's their moral obligation. So if on this bell curve, I would tell you this, I'm way more comfortable with the brawling and airing it out in public than I am with this slick, cowardly road that we've gone down to, in both Iraq and Afghanistan. To the nation and the region's detriment. So, that's what I think. So, have a fine afternoon. We will see you tomorrow morning here at the same time, 08 Pacific time, for a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.